Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never that debt is fraud. And you are actually tuned into the only content, whether it be video, whether it be audio, whether it be transmissions over the air, truly the only content that is actually helping anybody who wants to take this government back learn and understand what we need to do. And what we're doing is we're proving how we got there, because there's so much ambiguity. Oh, well, we assumed this. And the courts, if you go into court and you can't actually prove boom, 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 from this point all the way forward, this was clearly a usurpation. And actually, we have the whole trail. Now we've completed the whole trail, because as I did the last show on Monday, I found and I discovered this other, I'll call it, act in the, what was the Land Act of 1820, April 24, of course, 1820. And I'll get to the name of the act, but this is what it identified, the name of the act. An act concerning the mode of surveying the public lands of the United States, close quote. And this was passed on the 11th day, February 11th, 1805. So I pointed this out, and I said, well, now I've got another little rat hole to dive into. And technically, in doing the due diligence, I found three acts, including the one cited. And this, so and in so doing, I actually found a summary of how the public lands concept came to be. And so how they basically went down the path under the Articles of Confederation of using an act for what they called public lands. And I don't think that there wasn't anything in the Articles of Association to deal with this. It became a real stumbling block. So they ended up having to pass three acts. And those three acts were an act of 1785, an act of 1786, and then this third act. Both the act of 1785 and 1786 were made under the Articles of Confederation. And so when the Constitution was ratified in 1788 by, 11 states, then the Articles of Confederation and all of its acts were superseded. The Northwest Ordinance, being an act, was superseded. We went through this. So the process of how this new federal government was going to engage with public land was going to be different. And the concept of public land is the land that the federal government is in the stewardship of, or the legal possession of. A territory is land that the federal government has a stewardship over for the Union. Its responsibility is one of two, really, it can only do one of two things with that land. It can dispose of the land through a treaty by exchanging that land for something that the United States or the Union, the states, would want the general government to do to help benefit them, to help secure them for whatever purpose. So they could dispose of parts of the territory if necessary so that we could get a bigger chunk from somebody else, which is some of the things that has happened. Or they can admit that territory, prepare that territory, because they have that responsibility, stewardship, and prepare that part of the territory to be admitted as a state and become an additional parent to the federal government. In other words, the child has the responsibility, and actually, if you really think about it, you know, you have children, you have your oldest child, and that oldest child kind of helps babysit or tend to, and in this particular case, in the Constitution, when the child government admits a new state into the Union, it literally introduces a new parent to the compact. And that right there was the essence and design of the Constitution, that all states would be superior to the federal government in all things, other than those few things delegated to the federal government. So, what we're going to do, and I got to kind of close up here, we need to consider and constantly focus on learning, praying, and acting so that we can do and act upon the truth. See, when we're clinging to bad paradigms, and the bad paradigms are paradigms that actually keep us, because if you accept a paradigm that doesn't allow you to get into this path of interposition, then you've basically taken on a role, you've taken on a position that traps you. You've painted yourself into the corner. I'll give you a couple of examples on this, because the sovereign citizen movement, it's a very confusing umbrella. I call it the secession movement, actually. The secession movement is a movement that convinces you that there's these only paths to follow. One path is to actually dissolve yourself as a citizen of the United States, where you literally become incapable of participating within the process of getting the government into compliance. In other words, it's kind of like you divorce yourself from the union. The other path, or one of the other ways of going down this path, is the general assembly, these assemblies. Because if you are challenging the veracity of the government, the Constitution, because don't get confused, folks. The constitutional government is very specific. It is the government that is authorized by the Constitution, not the annotated Constitution, the original Constitution, that they only have three departments, and their roles, responsibilities, powers, properties, and so forth are fixed to that Constitution. So any property that they have that is not within that Constitution, not enumerated, is unconstitutional. Any role they're taking on, any responsibility, any power that they've assumed are unconstitutional if it has not been enumerated in that Constitution. So a general assembly, the people that fall into this, are those who truly believe that what the federal government is doing today is legitimate. They have worked their way into legitimizing their, and some people will call this, a criminal conspiracy, or a criminal operation, something like that, where, you know, they're just doing all of these evil things, and it's legitimate. They've legitimized their criminal architecture. That's not true. They have to have the authority to do anything legitimate. So anybody that tells you that what they're doing is legitimate, and you've got to get away from that, and we've got to set up this assembly, what you're really doing is you're creating a shadow government, and you're going into a world that puts you in basically you're insurrecting against the Constitution. Our job is to enforce the Constitution. Every citizen has this responsibility. I go into this all the time. There's another group out there that this, you know, a little bit lighter. And actually, there's two other groups that kind of fall under this, but I identify the nullifiers as a group that has fixed their eyes on doing something that is incapable of solving the problem. If you nullify laws, you have failed to fix the problem. You're just ignoring it. Nullification does not force the problem to be fixed. Interposition is the only process that does that. Therefore, there's another group out there that has completely perverted the paradigm, and it either is in the camp of nullification and or it is in the camp of actually creating and operating within a framework that is absolutely unconstitutional. And that group is the doctrine of the lesser magistrate. The concept of the doctrine of lesser magistrate is that the sheriff in this Republican form of government is the most powerful person in the county. That concept right there wipes out the people's representatives in our republican form of government, who are the sovereigns. Our legislators are the sovereigns. We've actually read through this in the ratification debates. And it wipes their position and their authority out and hands it to the sheriff. The sheriff doesn't have that type of authority. Under this new framework, the sheriff just becomes a top cop. The county should have an executive that actually, you know, is appointed by, and in an ideal setting, your county would have electors. And in an ideal setting, you wouldn't vote for your executive. You would vote for the electors in the county, and you'd vote for electors in the state, and you would vote for electors in the federal elections. And in those cases, that elector would then choose, for the county, would choose the executive, and the executive would, you know, or any other offices, such as the district attorney. A lot of places like to have the autonomy or the separation of the executive from so that they can't appoint their own sycophants. So the attorney general, the auditor, the secretary of state, because those types of positions under the U.S. Constitution, the president has the responsibility of appointing them. You can create it to where the electors will actually choose that person that they believe would be the best auditor, that person would be the best secretary, the best treasurer, the general positions at the county level. Now, you can have board of elections and those types of things, because in the school system, all of that type of stuff, that could actually become, because they're representatives of the people in these smaller categories. There's ways to break these things down. But in our republican form of government, the people actually choose their representatives primarily. And that's what I'm saying. If you look at the utility board, those would be and possibly could be your representatives. Or you could actually allow them to be appointments under the legislature. The legislature then would then select these people of the board, not the bureaucrat. So when you're creating a bureaucracy, there needs to be this accountability to the people. And usually when a person becomes, you know, gets to the executive level, they want to assume and have full control over that. But giving it to the representative body would kind of take care of that. But anyway, back to this doctrine of lesser magistrates. It perverts the relationship of the people and their government. And it actually assumes more of a, if you want to consider it a monarchy, it assumes this complete different character where the president or the governor or the executive, you know, actually in the county, they think that the sheriff's the top executive, and he's not. This is an old ideal that comes out of the British framework that we revolted against, that the Constitution revolted against and actually put us under. We do not have the doctrine of magistrates. Your judges are not magistrates. They are simply a person that is responsible for overseeing the trying of a case. And most cases are required by a jury trial. In other words, a trial by jury, not a jury trial. Let me clarify. I said jury trial, but it's actually a trial by jury. A jury trial is where the judge controls the jury. And a trial by jury is where the jury has full autonomy to make the decisions and have the power to do what's necessary. Like a grand jury. A grand jury is not controlled by, you know, the administrator, the DA, or whomever. The grand jury is a jury that has, they function in a very specific way, and there's an administrative management to make sure that they're being given the things that they need, they're being educated in how to function, how to act. And they come to conclusions. And a grand jury is usually formed in providing indictments for infamous crimes. The whole point here, folks, is that when we're looking at our government was designed a very specific way. And so we have to hold our government accountable. This is why we're going through how the government under the Constitution created and assumed a power that created a Ponzi scheme and actually put them, it completely perverted the system, because when the federal government could marshal this concept of public lands and literally transition this concept that all U.S. states, anything that is a part of the United States, is property of the federal government. That's how far they've taken this. And I have an article that will take you there, but what we have now are the three acts that were started under the Articles of Confederation, and then the final one, the third act of these three, was done under Thomas Jefferson's administration. And so I want to read to you the basic guidance that they put into this, because this is what they use for, I don't know what school system it is. It's, I think, Wiley University. And this is an appendix, Appendix E. This appendix contains three major land laws under which the Public Land Survey, or the GLO, which is the General Land Office system, was created, and the basic principles were identified. Each act is separate and distinct, and taken as a whole, they set the established rules that identify the system, and as such should be understood by the student and the practicing surveyor. The acts are summarized next in 1785. This is the summary of the act. The act of 1785 is famous not for what it said, but for what it did not state. This act created the system of 6 mile square townships that supposedly crossed at right angles an impossible request on a curved surface. Later, this would be recognized and the correction would be directed. The law provided that all lines would be measured with a chain. It failed to state the length of the chain. It also provided the numbering of the lots. Sections of 1906 would start in the, you know, sections in 1796 would start in the southeast corner of the township. In 1796, the Land Act of 1796 plugged some of the loopholes that were discovered in the Act of 1785. It specified the chain to be 2 perches in length. This is equated to a chain 33 feet long. It stated that lines would be to the true meridian. It set the method of section numbering starting in the northeast corner. The Act of 1805, the Act of February 11, 1805, legally was perhaps the most far-reaching of all of the land acts. The major provisions that are still in effect today are summarized as follows. The original surveys are without error in that distances and the courses recited in the field notes and noted on the plat are the true distances regardless of what the modern surveyor remeasures with modern equipment. It provided for legal, not unmonumented, corners primary to the center quarter, the center quarter corner, and the 1/16th corners. It identified the contents of the sections as returned to the plat will be the true contents of the sections. It held that the content of the half sections and quarter sections, the contents of which have been returned, but be considered as containing one half or one fourth respectively. This provision coined the term aliquot. The text, in whole or in part, of these lands are as follows. So now we're going to get into the Land Acts of 1785. And note, interesting, at the very top of this, it says 1785, 1786, and 1805. Then later they say that the second act was 1796. Now, okay, hold it. The Land Act of 1796 plugged some loopholes that were discovered in 1785. So is it 1796? We'll find out. So in the next act, or the first act, an ordinance for ascertaining the mode of disposing the lands in the Western Territory. Now, folks, I get it, that this is going into the process of surveying and controlling and regulating how to measure and all of that. The concepts is strictly for how they're to equate what the land is by the acre, by the corners and plats and so forth. So this is important because this is fed into the land acts or the public land acts that we just cited. Be it ordained by the United States and Congress assembled that the territory ceded by individual states to the United States, which had been purchased of the Indian inhabitants, shall be disposed of the following manner. Okay, so one of the things they just pointed out is that the land that they're about to survey was just purchased by the Indian inhabitants. A surveyor, now this is not like the wampums that paid for Manhattan. This is something that the United States Continental Congress purchased land from Indians. A surveyor from which each state shall be appointed by Congress or a committee of the states who shall take an oath for the faithful discharge of his duty before the geographer of the United States, who is hereby empowered and directed to administer the same, and the like oath shall be administered to each chain carrier by the surveyor under whom he acts. The geographer who under whose direction the surveyor shall act shall occasionally form such regulations for their conduct as he shall deem necessary, shall have authority to suspend them for misconduct in office, and shall make report of the same to Congress, to the Committee of the States, and he shall make report in case of sickness, death, or resignation of any surveyor. The surveyors, as they are respectively qualified, shall proceed to divide the said territory into townships of 6 mile squares, by lines running due north and south, and others crossing these at right angles, as near as may be, unless where the boundaries of the late Indian purchases may render the same impracticable, and then they shall depart from this rule no further than such particular circumstances may require. And each surveyor shall be allowed and paid at the rate of $2 for every mile in length he shall run, including the wages of the chain carriers, markers, and every other expense attending the same. Wow, $2. That's not bad, folks. But you're out there taking on risk and so forth. Nobody's protecting you, so I bet you these guys are pretty well on. But anyway, the first line running due north, and actually I got just less than a minute, so let me read the bold part. The first line running due north and south, as aforesaid, shall begin on the River Ohio at a point that shall be found to be due north from the western termination of a line which has been run as the southern boundary of the state of Pennsylvania. So they're closing in on how they're going to start taking and measuring and surveying the Northwest Ordinance. Now, if I remember correctly, the origins of this came from Thomas Jefferson. You got to remember, Thomas Jefferson's father was a surveyor. He was a surveyor for the British Crown, which is why he had the money that he had. And so, and unfortunately, Thomas Jefferson kind of squandered that. I don't know. I'd have to look. I guess he probably was the eldest son, because it seemed like he got the plantation and the estate that his father had, which he ended up losing because he got foreclosed on because he couldn't pay his debts. But that being said, when we come back, I'm going to dive into the rest of this. Why is this so important? Because, as you can see, there's these nuances within these bills that they assume they have the authority. Now, we're going to wait till the 1805 Act, not Bill, the Act, and we'll kind of discern and scrutinize what parts of that are where they are assuming things that they should never have assumed. Anyway, we'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let me get right back into this, because this is 12 pages, and I kind of want to wrap through this, even though it may not seem everything, you know, 100% of this is going to be pertinent. This is laying out how the government is assuming this control over this land. And they're going to survey it, and in so doing, they're claiming it. And so Continental Congress was claiming this land with these acts where they didn't have the authority. Just keep in mind, they created... So actually, 1783, the land was basically ceded to the United States by Britain. Technically... The Treaty of 1783 was a treaty that did not recognize the Continental Congress. It was a treaty that recognized the 13 independent states that they referred to as. So it was then dealing with, even though there were only a few representatives, it was dealing with this body of the whole of 13. Continental Congress, being kind of a separate autonomy, a general government, made the assumptions that they could actually go down this path outside of, because by the enumerations, and it was by necessity that they needed to do this, and so nobody challenged it. This is what happens when government is given, because if had they assumed other things, such as, you know, taxing them in ways they didn't have the authority, oh, the states would have jumped up and said, you can't do that. But in this particular case, it was something that was accepted by the states for them to just assume to do. Even though they had, how many, 8 amendments to the Articles of Confederation. Nevertheless, let me get into this. And the first line running east and west shall begin at the same point and shall extend through the whole territory, provided that nothing herein shall be construed as fixing the western boundary of the state of Pennsylvania. The geographer shall designate the townships or fractional parts of townships by numbers progressively from south to north, always beginning each range with number 1, and the ranges shall be distinguished by their progressive numbers to the westward, the range extending from Ohio to Lake Erie being marked number 1. The geographer shall personally attend to the running of the first east and west line, and shall take the latitude of the extremes of the north, south, and the south line, of the first north and south line, and of the mouths of the principal rivers. The lines shall be measured with a chain, shall be plainly marked by chaps on the trees, and shall exactly describe on a plat, whereon shall be noted by the surveyor as their proper distances. All mines, salt springs, salt licks, and mill seats that shall come to his knowledge, and all watercourses, mountains, and other remarkable and permanent things over the near which such line shall pass, and also the quality of the lands. The plats, so in other words, they're just basically doing, marking the ground and making assessments. In essence, what they're really doing is they're mapping it out. The plats of the townships respectively shall be marked by subdivisions into lots of 1 mile square or 640 acres in the same direction as the external lines and numbered from 1 to 36, always beginning at the succeeding range of the lots with the number next to what to that with which the preceding one concluded, and where from the causes before mentioned, only a fractional part of a township shall be surveyed. The lots protracted thereon shall bear the same numbers as if the township had been entire, and the surveyors, in running the external lines of the townships, shall at the interval of every mile mark corners of the lots which are adjacent, always distinguishing the same in the different manner of those of the townships. The geographer and surveyor shall pay the utmost attention to the variation of the magnetic needle and shall run and note all lines by the true meridian, certifying with every plat what was the variation of the times of running the lines thereon noted. As soon as seven ranges of townships and fractional parts of the townships in the same direction from south to north shall have surveyed, the geographer shall transmit plats thereon to the Board of Treasury, who shall record the same with the report in well-bound books to be kept for that purpose. The geographer shall make similar returns from time to time of every seven ranges as they may be surveyed. The Secretary at War shall have recourse thereto and shall take by lot therefrom a number of townships and fractional parts of the townships, as well from those to be sold entire as those to be sold in lots, as will be equal to 1/7 part of the whole of such seven ranges, as nearly as may be, for the use of the late Continental Army, and he shall make a similar draught from time to time until sufficient quantity is drawn to satisfy the same, to be applied in manner therein directed. The Board of Treasury shall from time to time cause the remaining numbers, as well those to be sold entire as those to be sold in lots, to be drawn for the name of the 13 states respectively according to the quotas in the preceding requisition on all of the states, provided that in case more land than its proportion is allotted for sale in any state at any distribution, a deduction shall be made therefore at the next. So it's interesting that they were planning on giving to the veterans of the Revolutionary War these small little parcels of land where they could go stake their claim and have, you know, start their own plantation, start their own farm. The Board of the Treasury shall transmit a copy of the original plats previously noted thereon the townships and fractional parts of townships, which shall have fallen to the several states by the distribution aforesaid to the commissioners of the loan office of the several states, who, after giving notice of not less than 2 nor more than 6 months, by causing advertisements to be posted up at the courthouses or other noted places in every county, and be inserted in one newspaper published in the states of their residence respectively, shall proceed to the sell the townships of fractional parts of townships at public venue. We say venue. In the following manner, viz., the township or fractional part of the township number 1 in the second range shall be sold by lots, and number 2 in the same range entire, and so in alternate order through the whole of the second range and the third range, shall be sold in the same manner as the first, and the fourth in the second manner as the second, and thus alternately throughout all the ranges, provided that none of the lands within the said territory be sold under the price of $1 the acre, to be paid in specie or loan offices certificates reduced to the specie value by the sale or of depreciation or certificates of liquidated debts of the United States including interest besides the expense of the survey and other charges thereon, which are hereby rated at $36 the township in specie or certificates as aforesaid, and so in the same proportion for fractional part of the township or of a lot to be paid at the time of sales, on failure of which payment the said lands shall again be offered for sale. Now, it's kind of interesting because they're putting the prices in here, and it became noted in the very first session of Congress that the money that they had allocated to do everything, basically they made really no money. In other words, they were losing money because that's what they were complaining about, because the fees that were being added to the surveying and all of that basically left a zero return, and actually it was creating a liability for the new federal government. Anyway, so that's one of the reasons why they wanted to make these significant changes of how they were going to survey and move forward in doing everything, instead of, you know, having to pay for everything up front. There shall be reserved for the United States out of every township the four lots being numbered 8, 11, 26, 29, and out of every fractional part of the township so many lots of the same numbers as shall be found thereon the future sale. There shall be reserved the lot number 16 of every township for the maintenance of the public schools within the said township. Right there is where the Continental Congress was making the assertion where the federal government couldn't actually do that. The federal government allowed the people had to do this. In other words, they could make the rules and regulations, but when the state became the state would take over. They wouldn't be bound by whatever the federal government had done. Now, even though the federal government may have put things in motion, what literally probably happened, because I can understand it, is that the federal government had claimed that these lands were marked for education, and they moved forward with that, and they did that. But they weren't bound to that. If they would have realized, well, now, you know, 20 years later, we think a little wiser that it'd be better to put the school over here than over there because everything else fell into place backwards. So, moving forward, also one-third of all gold, silver, lead, and copper mines to be sold or otherwise disposed of as Congress shall hereafter direct. Here are the terms of the deed to be given when a township or a lot is sold, which deeds shall be recorded in proper books by the commissioner of the loan office and shall be certified to have been recorded previously to their being delivered to the purchaser and shall be good and valid to convey the lands in the same described. The commissioners of the loan offices, respectively, shall transmit the Board of Treasury every 3 months an account of the townships, fractional parts of townships, and lots committed to their charge, specifying therein the names of persons to whom sold and the sums of money or certificates received for the same, and shall cause all certificates by them received to be struck through with a circular punch, and shall be duly charged in the books of the Treasury, with the amount of the money or certificates distinguished the same by them received as aforesaid. If any township or fractional part of a township or lot remains unsold for 18 months after the plat shall have been received by the commissioners of the loan office, the same shall be returned to the Board of Treasury and shall be sold in such manner as Congress may hereafter direct. Now again, this is all moving forward with this presumption that this act is giving them the authority to do these things. You got to remember, this is the Articles of Confederation. And whereas Congress, by the resolutions of September 16th and 18th, in the year 1776, and in the 12th of August, 1780, stipulated grants of land to certain officers and soldiers of the late Continental Army, and by the resolution of the 22nd September 1780, stipulated grants of land to certain officers in the hospital department of the late Continental Army, for complying therefore with such engagements, be it ordained that the Secretary of War, from the returns of his office, or such other sufficient evidence as the nature of the case may admit, determine who are objects of the above resolutions and engagements, and the quantity of land to which such persons or their representatives are respectively entitled, and cause the townships or fractional parts of the townships hereinbefore reserved for the use of the late Continental Army to be drawn for in such manner as he shall deem expedient to answer the purpose of an impartial distribution. He shall from time to time transmit certificates to the commissioner of the loan offices of the different states to the lines of which the military claimants have respectively belonged, specifying the name and rank of the party, the terms of his engagements, and the time of his service, and the division, brigade, regiment, or company to which he belonged, the quantity of land he is entitled to, and the township or fractional part of the township and range out of which is portion to his to is to be taken. So let me take a quick examination of this. So when they were looking for people to serve, they basically promised them that they would, the slaves would be freed at the end of the Revolutionary War if they served. So they all kind of joined, and they took names, and they made sure that all these things were documented so that they could honor this obligation that they gave these people. And so in the Continental Congress, they were basically actualizing this responsibility, this debt. Now, just to prove and just to show the sad intent of the obligations of debts and so forth by the Continental Congress, of what they had done, that the Constitution didn't pick those things up, that's exactly what happened. If anybody that knows anything about how the Revolutionary War veterans were treated, some of them were getting their land until the Constitution came in. Then everything shifted. The Constitution didn't account for these, and they didn't carry over these obligations. Right, wrong, or indifferent, they didn't carry them over. They formed a new government. They didn't consider these things, and the obligations portion that they put into the Constitution was literally for the external obligations, internal stuff. The Constitution basically assumed all authority over everything, and it didn't honor any of that. So when this became news, the veterans of the Revolutionary War kind of descended upon the federal government. And they weren't happy, and I believe this is when they were in Philadelphia, because the first 2 years they were up in New York. And what ended up happening was these veterans basically came in to start burning down these buildings and this new federal government, and going after them because they literally tore asunder a contract that they had. Washington, and all these men were kind of gathered in a very large hall building where as many could fit into this. It was packed. And Washington went into that, and I really don't know the details. All I know in a very, overview is Washington went in, he calmed everybody down, and he said, "Let me take care of this. We'll do everything we can to honor that debt." Whether that debt was honored, I couldn't tell you. And what and how that happened, I really can't give you the details. But I do know that this actually happened. And because these men had respect for General Washington, now the President of the United States, they believed, and I think they kind of broke and went back home after Washington said, I'll take care of this. Whether he did or not is another story. I can tell you that right there kind of speaks to how the federal government ever since then has failed to live up to their obligations to the military when they've made them. They have constantly turned their backs on the military. And I don't think that was the spirit of the Constitution. But you got to remember that that contract was made outside of the Constitution. It was made as the Articles of Association and Articles of Confederation. And right, wrong, or indifferent, it became problematic of how to deal with it. But moving forward, you would have thunk that they would learn their lesson and actually start honoring these debts, start honoring these obligations that they were making to those men that were putting their lives on the line. And so, as we've seen, the people that always get screwed over are always the veterans. Always the veterans. Now, I'm just, you know, I've got to dig a little bit here. If you are inclined to call the vets to stand, to honor them for their service, then your obligation isn't to have them stand and make you feel better to clap. Your obligation is to get the government to hold their obligations to these veterans and honor them. Hold them to honoring their obligations. If you do that, then you are honoring the veterans. If you're just having them stand up so you can clap and make yourself look good, like, if, yo, how patriotic I am because I'm clapping for you, you're the problem. Your kids down the road may end up serving, or your grandchildren, and they're going to be discarded, they're going to be dishonored, and you are only perpetuating the problem. We have to hold government accountable to those obligations. And Congress didn't want to give up any of their, you know, their gold parachutes and the money that they were putting in for themselves, so they stuck it to the military. And they've always done this. And my point is, here they're really actually honoring the debt as they're moving forward. The first thing that they mentioned in here was to honor that debt. Okay, so the commissioners of the loan offices shall execute deeds for such undivided proportions of proportions in manner and form herein before mentioned, varying only in such a degree as to make the same conformable to the certificate from the Secretary at War, where any military claimant of bounty in lands shall not have been belonged to the line and the particular state. Similar certificates shall be sent to the Board of Treasury, who shall execute deeds to the parties for the same. The Secretary of War from the proper returns shall transmit to the Board of Treasury a certificate specifying the name and rank of the several claimants of the hospital department of the late Continental Army, together with the quantity of land each claimant is entitled to, and the townships or fractional part of townships and range out of which his portion is to be taken, and thereupon the Board of Treasury shall proceed to execute deeds to such claimants. The Board of Treasury and the commissioners of the loan offices in the state shall within 18 months return receipts to the Secretary of War for all deeds which have not been delivered, as also all original deeds which remain in the hands for want of applicants having been first recorded, which deeds so returned shall be preserved in the office until the parties of their representatives require the same. You know, what's really interesting that just came to me while I'm reading this is this area of Ohio that was being settled, this first area, was going to be the area of the Patriots. In other words, this area should be probably the reddest, the most patriotic, the most constitutional-loving area, because this is where the parents, the men who fought in the Revolutionary War, who fought for freedom, the first cause, you know, under this government in standing up for freedom and individual liberty, individual sovereignty. So you think, you know, that this would be the nucleus of the patriotic center of America, at least at that time. And to be foreordained, the three townships adjacent to Lake Erie be reserved to be hereafter disposed of in Congress for the use of the officers, men, and other refugees from Canada and the refugees from Nova Scotia who or may be entitled to grants of land under resolutions or Congress now existing or which may hereafter be made respecting them and for such purposes as Congress may hereafter direct. And it be further ordained that the towns of Gedenhutten, Schönbrunn, and Salem, and on the Muskingum, I think this is up in the Nova Scotia area, and so much of the lands adjoining to the said towns, with the buildings and improvements thereon, shall be reserved for the sole use of the Christian Indians who were formerly settled there, or the remains of that society, as may, in the judgment of the geographer, be sufficient for them to cultivate, saving the reserving always to all officers, soldiers entitled to lands on the northwest side of Ohio, by donation or bounty from the Commonwealth of Virginia, and to all persons claiming under them all rights to which they are so entitled under the deed of cession executed by the delegates of the state of Virginia on the first day of March 1784, and the act of Congress accepting the same, and to that end that the said rights may be fully and effectually secured according to the true intent and meaning of the said deed of cession and act aforesaid. Be it ordained that no part of the land, including between the rivers called Little Miami and Scioto, on the northwest side of the river of Ohio, be sold or in any manner alienated until there shall be first have laid off and appropriated for the said officers and soldiers and persons claiming under them the lands they are entitled to agreeably to the said deed of cession and the act of Congress accepting the same. Right here is just a further testament that we're looking at, you know, how they were honoring those obligations in making sure that they were giving the land that they promised these men. So, we've got just a minute left. What we're really trying to do here by going through this is that there's all these little historical points that we can make out of these things. But what we're really doing is we're just showing how Continental Congress, by this act, assumed something that they really didn't have under the Articles of Association. This kind of set the stage for them to create the Northwest Ordinance. Now, I believe that even though they went down this path of this act in 1785, there were problems because the Northwest Ordinance had to be created after this. And when you look at the Northwest Ordinance, which we had just read not too long ago, the Northwest Ordinance kind of injected that, you know, this area be developed and so forth. And I don't know if it was in harmony with this act of surveying and then disposing, or I should say distributing, these parcels of land to honor these people, these veterans. So we'll dive more into this on Monday. And next week, probably next Friday, I will hopefully be able to air an interview I had with Bill Cole, who is the founder of Peace Through Strength Institute, and who is an advocate for the Ukrainian, our involvement in supporting Ukraine. And so we're moving forward. I'm going to be picking up these interviews as we move forward as well. I just want you to know, folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.